Friday I will go to the hair cutter. I need a haircut.
Okay. But we can't see that because we're an audio.
Yeah.
It's the podcast called Scene World. I'm me, he's him. In a minute, we're going to be talking to Andrew and Silvio from some magazine called Scene World. I've never really heard of it before, but apparently they're doing issues and stuff. So
for years and years.
So we're going to talk to them in a bit. We've been talking about doing this episode for a year now. Yeah, yep. For a year, where we talk, you know, just kind of because one of the things that we noticed that happens every so often is that we start doing an intro and then somewhere in the intro we end up talking about how Scene World began and what has happened to it. And so we've been trying our best not to do that. And in place of doing that, we figured, why don't we just bring in some of the guys that were there from the beginning, namely Andrew and Silvio, and, you know, just
and
kind
other
of
other people too, of
yeah,
course.
Well, obviously, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But just kind of sit back and.
But we can't get everybody at the same time.
Yeah,
so.
It'll be a. Right. So we figured, you know, we'll have them on and we'll just kind of talk and just kind of BS about what's happened in the last 15 years.
Wow.
But before we get going on that, we have some things that have occurred. David Bowie died.
Oh yeah, that's pretty sad.
That sucked. He did put out a new album a couple days ago, and it's freaking amazing. So that is.
And didn't somebody else die named Lemmy?
Yes, Lemmy Kilminster from.
At 70.
Yes, he. Those are two guys that kind of you always thought were, you know, there's a couple of rock stars that sort of fall into this immortal category, like Alice Cooper or Ozzy or, you know, or David Bowie. They aren't supposed to die.
Mm. I mean, even though if they were not musicians, nowadays you don't die at 70. It's pretty.
Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not like, oh, I'm hitting 70 now. I'm very, very old. We are no longer living in the 70s or 80s, where people are stone old when they hit 70.
Yeah. Well, you know, David Bowie was only 69.
So, yeah.
So Lemmy, I can kind of understand because he didn't live easy.
So. Yeah, and the problem was with Lemmy is he learned 2 days before he died that he had cancer. So cancer was detected too late.
Yeah, you know? Bowie knew he had it for 18 months, evidently. And I mean, there was a picture that was taken of him 2 days before he died, and he looked perfectly fine. Like there, you'd never know. He was dressed up, and he was out, he was smiling. So.
Ooh, yeah. Anyway, we are talking about the undead retro scene and stuff.
Yeah.
So, what can we say?
Well, let's go backpedal a little bit, because one of our first interviewees was CinemaWare. They were trying to do Rocket Ranger Reloaded, and whilst the Kickstarter was a success, things conspired afterwards to make it not so much of a success. And so they've been going through the process of refunding money and doing this and that. And they just recently sent out an email to everyone about, that wasn't Rocket Ranger. It was,
Rocket Ranger and Defender of the Crown.
Right. And the email essentially said that it's going to be the release for it will be a bit delayed.
So here's the first update of the pre-orders of Defender of the Crown Extended Collector's Edition.
Mm-hmm.
That means all the versions that were ever released of the Defender of the Crown are in that package.
Right.
And as you mentioned, Wings Remastered, but for the Amiga.
Right.
That's a different release.
Yes.
So Defender of the Crown will be bigger than originally expected. So this means instead of one CD, now it will be three CDs. Because now there's also the Defender of the Crown 2 release connected and embedded in it, which was released for the PC.
So that's not the worst news in the world, because you're getting more than you bargained for.
Exactly. Yes. You're getting three times as much as you were paying for in the pre-order. So you get even more value for
the money. You know, I really give them some credit in that they've communicated really well, and they've been very they've done everything they can to make the deal better for everybody.
Yes, of course. But on the other hand, they also got a lot of criticism for waiting so long till they told people that they are having to refund.
And you don't want to tell people that you got a refund, because you know if there's a chance that you don't, right? If there's a chance that you can make it, you wait till the last minute. You don't just come out in the beginning and be like, "Oh yeah, we're going to do a refund because you know we predict that this isn't going to work in a month." No, you got to wait until you know for certain that, oh yeah, this is not going to work. We need to refund your money. Sorry. So I don't blame them for that. And you know, it's a very difficult business, and we've seen it ourselves trying to do an issue, and we end up running late. And you know, I mean, there's a lot of work involved.
Yeah, I know. Each time we are running late on an issue, I'm getting tons of questions. Like, when is a new issue coming out? How about my interview? Is it ever going to be released? I'm always saying, yes, we are working on it. It's going to be released. Yes, there will always be a winter and a summer issue. Always. We are not planning to not release your stuff or not release your interview. It will come.
We're going
to
take your interview and just put it in a box somewhere, and it'll never see the light of day. Sorry.
No, I mean, yeah. That's exactly the problem, yeah.
Yeah.
But in our case, there's no money involved, and that's of course making things a bit more relaxed.
So that happens. CinemaWare is
yeah. And there's another thing that also got delayed.
Oh,
yes. I did an interview in 2013 with Sherry Ellsworth.
Yes,
you know. The self-taught chip designer.
I am. I know Jerry. Yes.
Yeah, you know, and she does this cast AR, this augmented reality classes.
Right.
And they are going to be delayed for 2 years. So they decided to refund everybody, and you are getting what you pledged for, or at least. Maybe more or less, depends on what you pledged for. But anyway, despite you getting a refund till the end of February, mm-hmm. you are getting the consumer edition of the glasses for free when they are going to be released in 2017.
Okay.
And that's thumbs up.
Pretty nifty.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
That's a good deal. I've never... Augmented reality glasses, is that what happened? Remember Google Glass was real big like a year ago. Everybody was talking about, oh, Google Glass, if you sign up, you might be able to get one for only, you know, $12 trillion and whatnot. And then there was a couple of people that I know that had them, and they were walking around looking like dorks with them, and it was in the news, people taking videos when they shouldn't have been and crap like that. And then it just sort of, where did it go? What happened? No one's got them anymore.
Anyway, now, a few days ago, they announced that the Oculus Rift is finally there, the consumer edition. And hold your breath, for 742 euros, that's even more than you Americans pay. That's, like, incredible,
I'll just
you know?
Strap an iPad to my face. Why, you know...
Yeah, actually, there are glasses for the Samsung Galaxy.
Right. Well, you know,
like that.
See, the Google Glass, when that came out, I could understand the concept behind it to the point where it wasn't. I got it. And the Oculus, I get, but the thing is that the Oculus strikes me as something that would be useful if something is made for it. Right. So and not every game is going to be made for the Oculus to the point where it's going to be useful to the vast majority of gamers. Maybe one or two people. You're not going to be reading your email with the Oculus. You know, that's not what it's going to be used for. Yeah. You're going to spend you know, $800, you're going to buy the stupid thing. You're going to use it like twice, and it's going to go in a closet someplace, you know, until such time as new games are made for it, in which case it'll probably be the Oculus 2 and it will be incompatible.
Yeah, but it's good to know, because I was doing an interview with Chuck Paddle, who was the guy who invented the first low-cost CPU, mm-hmm. and he had the same discussion with people about who needs a personal computer back in the 70s. So,
but, you know, personal computer is way more practical as far as what you can do with it than the glasses are, because or the Oculus, which isn't glasses. It's more like you're strapping a shoebox onto your face. You know, it's this big, bulky thing that you're not going to go out in public with, that because you're going to walk into stuff because you can't see anything. Yeah. You know?
Well, that's a good thing about augmented reality. You can still see your surroundings.
That's like with the Google glasses. And I'm saying it weird, but the Google glasses. It's the same thing with that, where you can see what's going on, and it's just a little kind of thing. But, you know, it doesn't seem to have caught on. Like, no one uses them anymore. Nobody cares about it anymore. I don't think they're selling them. I haven't seen any ads for them.
No, they stopped.
Yeah.
They stopped.
Right, so.
Yeah. Google said they want to reinvent the market and reinvent the product.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What that means is it was a failure, and now they have to backpedal and figure something else out.
Yeah, that's basically the thing. Anyway, I think it's a win-win situation.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have backed for Cast AR. I'm one of those people who didn't ask for a refund because it was delayed.
Right.
And that is what many people don't understand. Kickstarter is not a store. You can wait years for your product to get ever out, or you lose your money if you are bad.
Right.
Luck. But I only beg for people that I trust in. And I mean, Jerry Ellsworth, she cannot take the money and run away.
Right.
Nobody would like to talk to her in the Commodore 64 scene anymore if she was doing that. You would lose your face totally.
Yeah, well, no, so, I mean, it's an investment platform. And when you pledge money towards something, you're investing in that product. And whether that product comes to light or not, you know, that's when CinemaWare said that, you know, they're not, they couldn't do it. You know, they were successful on Kickstarter, but they couldn't raise the extra money that they needed to do it. And they were willing to refund everyone's money. I just, you know, I didn't pledge a huge amount to begin with, but
I did.
Right. But I, you know, I said, you know, look, I keep it because I invested in a product that, granted, the product didn't get made, but that doesn't negate my investment in it. Okay, so I bet and I lost. Oh, well.
Well, I see it in the way I shifted the money. I got it back, but then I used it for pre-orders of their other games, their collection that is coming now out. So that's quite good. Though they are not losing my money. But they are getting.
They're not losing.
They're giving something else.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's a year of the refunding for me. Of course, a lot of projects that were funded, actually, I got a refund, which is quite good because I invested that instantly in a Transcribe and other bills I had to pay regarding to Scene World. So it's quite good. And, you know, Christmas is always a month and a time where you are short on money because you need to buy presents and stuff.
Yes.
And make travels to see your family and stuff. Mm-hmm. So didn't really hurt me too much.
How were your holidays? Well, you know what? I'll ask that later.
Right.
Yeah. So, what else we got? We got a video game con happened in September in Jersey, and we've just received word that dates have been set for a video game con 2016. This will be taking place on September 10th and 11th at the same place, Parsippany, New Jersey, Grandma's house. So,
wow.
I'll be there again doing something. I don't know who. Right now it's very, very preliminary planning. They don't, you know, there's no guests or anything that are really kind of.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say you should do some interviews next time.
Yeah. No, I'll be infinitely more prepared, I think, next time. Maybe we'll bump into to Lily and Vanka from our last podcast, who were at a video game con last year. Maybe they'll be doing
a live show just for you.
yeah, that would be unusual. You know, I want to point out, I thought about saying it during our podcast with them, and I didn't. But when I was at a video game con, I'm there essentially to take videos and pictures and, you know, experience the whole thing. But it was incredibly uncomfortable to take video during the burlesque show, because I'm standing there and there's girls stripping and I've got my phone out and I'm taking videos of it. And now they said in the very beginning, they said, hey, take videos. That's cool. Just tag us so we know where to find it. You know, but at the same, and everybody else was taking videos too. But I felt creepy being the guy standing there with my phone out taking videos of girls stripping. And I felt like I almost wanted to go up to them during the podcast and be like, look, I had to take these videos for Scene World. These aren't for my personal use.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. So there's that. So if you want to go and look up that, a video game con, it's on Facebook. There's a webpage for it. I don't know if the webpage has been updated. I'll look at that right now.
Charlie, a video game con, AVGC.
I think it's just a videogamecon.com, and that's exactly what it is. Yeah, they haven't updated it yet. So, but it's a videogamecon.com. If you want to go to the website, it's not updated, so you're not going to learn anything. Or just do a search on Facebook for a video game con 2016, and you'll find information for it, and keep up to date, and get tickets, and go to it, and.
And we will put links in our description.
Yep, all that stuff and homey who.
Yeah.
What else? Hey, Star Wars. Do you see Star Wars?
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, what'd you think?
I really liked how fit Han Solo was.
Yes, you know? Yes. He's a
wow. I mean,
he's a fine man, yes.
You know, I mean, 70, over 70, and still being so fit.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. I saw it in theaters. It was funny because I saw it open. Well, actually, it was the day before opening. I don't know exactly how that worked because it opened up on the opening date was whenever it was, and I saw it the day before, which was kind of
yes. Strange. It's a pre-show. I did that too with the last James Bond.
Oh, okay. So yeah, so we went and saw it.
Preview.
And,
they call it preview.
Yeah. And as we file into the theater. A woman comes in and yells at everyone to turn off their cell phones, and they had people. They said that there was people that were undercover in the theater, and if they saw any cell phones, police would be called and we would be taken out. Which I've never been to a movie where they did that, where they threatened you with being removed from the theater by police officers. But wow. I guess they got to prevent bootlegging, and that's reasonable.
Mm. Of course, yeah.
What else we got going on?
Right. Well, we got video reviews.
Yes, we do.
Wow, my God. 14,000 views?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Jesus.
Kevin Castiles is our newest staff member, and he's been doing video reviews, and he did one for the...
Wi-Fi modem.
Yes, the Commodore Wi-Fi modem, and it was... well received. We just put up another one by him for the C64 Reloaded motherboard, which is also another very good, cool review. Yeah, so check them out. We'll be doing more. Jörg will be putting up his unboxing of the Commodore phone any day now.
Yes, and AJ will do the review because I sent him a parcel today with the phone,
yes.
And he will do the review because... I think he's a better guy for it because he was kind of, like, and I think he is the person to be either convinced or confirmed.
Yeah. So.
Whether the phone is really crap or not. And it's something that we were asked a couple of times since we announced you received the unit, like, is it crap? Is it good? AJ will find out.
Yep. So that's going on. We're doing stuff with our YouTube channel now.
Oh yeah.
And it's very it's interesting and fun that it's actually being used more than just a receptacle for bits and pieces. There's regular things now. And Andrew did a review of Heroes and Cowards, which I think we talked about in the last podcast. And
finally, you can see where we failed. So,
and John did a 2015 retrospective of the, you know, holiday demos and stuff of the season. So that's up there. Yeah, so go check out our YouTube page and like and subscribe, as they say.
Yeah, and it's funny because people are like, wow, something scene related.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, we are called Scene World, aren't we?
Yeah.
That the demo scene isn't just everything that we cover. We also cover different stuff.
Well, we cover other a lot stuff. Of, yeah, we cover a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily scene related. So, okay, what else have we got?
Bombshell.
Yes. Is going
to release January 29th, okay. Finally.
Yeah.
Frederick Schreiber announced it.
Okay.
29th. And yes. Scott Miller did thumbs up. He approved the gameplay already.
Awesome.
So, are you going to be a customer?
Maybe.
Maybe. it's kicking ass. You have to. Maybe there's a battle mode. Maybe we can kick each other's ass.
Mac version?
Well, I don't know, actually.
Is there ever?
I don't know. But actually, now you have a Windows laptop.
Yes, so. I do. Right behind me. It's over there.
Yeah, I see. Woo! Anyway. On the 30th of January, J.I., Kevin, Oliver, and Leaf will play online to play NetRacer and this shoot 'em up game in multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And we will talk to that guy. And that's the same guy who also did Leaf Bloomsquist, who also did the Wi-Fi modem. So yes. See us at twitch.tv/sceneworld.
Or you can go to our website and go to the Twitch tab and you can see it there as well.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, see?
Leave us a follow and notifications, switch it on, to not miss a show in the future.
Yes.
Anyway, it will be on the 30th January at 2 p.m. New York City time.
Yep.
Or 8 p.m. Central European time.
Mm-hmm.
And cool. That will be our first live and network online gaming. So we are making something new here.
We'll see how many times things go wrong. Yet.
Pardon?
See how many times things go wrong.
Well, this is why I said we should meet an hour before, so can make sure that things are not happening in the wrong way. So AJ will be the moderator and answer your questions in the chat. So this will be our first live Let's Play, or
aside from the
multiplayer
extra thing back in November.
Yeah, our first retro network playing thing.
There you go.
And I think nobody ever did on Twitch a C64 network game.
I can't imagine that even many people have done it in real life.
Yes.
Let alone on Twitch. So.
Yes. So, Scene World, we are the first again. Thumbs up.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, we just have crazy ideas, and we do them.
And we're crazy enough to try to do them.
Yes. And with some success, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, did we ever do anything that miserably failed?
Trying to play Pro Evolution Soccer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But then we figured out it was a network issue.
Yeah.
Not our fault.
Right. Okay, so we're here. We have Andrew and Sylvia, who are they are some of the first people to work on Scene World from the very beginning. The driving force behind starting it. So how are you guys?
Yeah, I'm fine and thanks.
Yeah, good to be here.
And I just realized that, you know, Sylvia, we've worked together on this for 15 years or so, and I think this is the first time that I'm actually speaking to you.
Yeah, right. No, that's right. That's right. 15 years already.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember back then I was still living with my mom, and every time I was calling, she was asking me, "Is it Italy or UK?" Because mostly I was talking to Andrea or Silvio on the phone. So, but thanks to modern technology, now we can talk all together at Skype. So
yeah.
Sure, it is more better than the BBS.
Oh yeah. Oh good lord, yeah. I think York found me through email.
So he
started harassing me to do something for the magazine.
And Andrew actually wrote a letter, and Silvio was leaving a guestbook entry in the People of Liberty guestbook. This is how I found you guys, and I was like, "Oh, I need your help." So, right. So, let's first start with what were actually your reasons, Andrew, to start helping at the Scene World magazine?
Well, at the time, I was basically just a member of the group Ozone, which was formed by a guy in the Republic of Ireland, and he had left the scene and wasn't doing much. And so I carried on writing a few demos and doing some music myself. And then in 2000, Jörg approached me and asked if I'd be interested in helping on Scene World. And so that's the nub of the story. I'm also a writer professionally. I write for computer magazines, including Retro Gamer. And prior to working on Scene World, I was actually part of the commercial magazine Zap64, which became Commodore Force and then later Commodore Format. And so through the 1990s, I was working on various fanzines and one or two very small disc mags that didn't get much circulation. So, you know, I liked writing about the 64. I knew quite a bit about it. And, you know, so opportunity to write about it was something I wanted to do.
You also have a book out, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, yes. I published a book in 2008 through Hive Publications. This was looking back at some of the best Commodore 64 games from 1982 right up to the 2000s, going from the earliest commercial releases from Commodore and companies like that through hugely famous games like Whizball. There's one or two games in there that I like, which people may not have heard of. And then sort of coming right up to the present day with modern releases, the homebrew, and that sort of release that has kept the Commodore going.
Is that still available? Can people still get that?
It's difficult to get hold of. You can find it on Amazon, the Commodore 64 book, 1982s and 19XX. Unfortunately, the publisher's had a few problems. There is still stock available. It's just a question of getting hold of him and getting it to the hands of people.
I will not sell mine because I was mentioned in the foreword for a special motivation kicker to Andrew.
That's right. I did say there was quite a few people I thanked, for example, Michael at Gamebase for allowing me to use some images, and the various people who'd helped me along the way with the book, and Jörg, because he, you know, with Scene World, I kept my interest in the Commodore 64 going, and that meant when the time was right, I was ready to write the book.
I keep pushing people to keep on.
he's a pain in the ass, is what he is.
Yeah. So, Silvio, what was your reason to answer my question and say, yes, I'm going to help there and start a disc mag with somebody I've never spoken to before?
Yes, you know, because it's happened so much time ago, so I have to recall exactly the moment. What I remember is that you asked me to join the Scene World mag back then. And at the beginning, I was, a bit shy because I don't know exactly what to write for Commodore 64 mag. Then, I started with little articles about what I like, mainly for the cracking scene. than the demo scene, because I am personally more focused on the cracking scene. Then I saw that the mag started a bit to growing up, and now I think that actually is a good standard, because also the NTSC scene is covered, not only PAL, because I think mostly MAG in the past mainly covered the PAL scene and not the NTSC scene.
As Silvio said, there was very little coverage of the NTSC scene. A lot of people will be aware of Driven, and Jörg said that was one of the things he looked to when he started Scene World, was looked at Driven covering the NTSC scene and said, well, is there a way we can include coverage of both scenes? Get the whole world involved in the mag, cover so much more of what is happening.
It was to merge two worlds. Because it seemed it was a clash of words, because PAL scene doesn't interest so much of the NTSC scene. The PAL scene, I think it was what can I say? There is a superior mind about the NTSC scene. Okay. Most game was cracked in PAL side, and then it was brought in the NTS scene with BBS. So it was like the NTS scene couldn't survive without the PAL. Instead, the PAL could survive for its alone.
There's been a kind of a conception of the NTSC scene as something that is almost derivative. It isn't its own independent thing. It needs to. It's kind of like the little brother of the PAL scene that never quite lived up to the same potential.
Yeah. And I mean, I think both scenes were very inward looking, in that you would tend to trade more mail swap in the past, and now even with websites, there tends to be more focus on your scene rather than the other scene, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Even a site like the Commodore Scene Database, yes, it acknowledges NTSC releases, but if you look, there is still more coming from the PAL scene, and it does seem to focus more.
What you consider that. If you look at the past two, the most high quality crackers and coder are from the PAL scene. That's not that's not to say we are best. We are the best fuck the rest. Okay, but this is how the situation was and today is. Because there is more activity in PAL scene, and the past there was the NTSC scene was more focused on import than cracking, training, and so on. The real power of the NTSC scene was the import from PAL, and then the best group can do an NTSC fix on PAL games.
There was also a big user group base in the US which didn't really go outside of the US. You know, just people that would sort of, they didn't produce too much, or if they did, it was very simple, basic stuff, you know, and that was sort of one of the, you know, kind of the mentality of this area was, you know, not so much on demos, but more on productivity and you know, yes, sharing just, you know, little things.
Well, if you look at a lot of the public domain discs you could get here in the UK, a lot of that software was coming from the States. And as you say, a lot of it was productivity or was simpler games. I won't say they were simple and ordinary, but then a lot of the material that was coming from Computes Gazette and Run, people would modify it, hack it in their own way, make a few changes, and publish it as a new item. Mm-hmm. And so we would get a lot of that coming over to the UK, released as public domain.
Hmm. We had a lot of budget games that you'd get over here. There was one that was, it was everywhere, Key Punch Software. I played on our Extra Life thing, I played a couple of the games from that, and they're fairly terrible games usually. I don't know where they came from. I have seen them over and over and over again places, like the same game I'll see on this disc, and then there's some other publishing company, you know, budget games that's got it over here. So, you know, I don't know how that worked logistically, if like the authors of these are just kind of like shelling them out to different publishers being like, yeah, here's a new game. You know, and just kind of getting paid four or five times or how it works, but it's...
Well, I came across an example of that recently. We were discussing a game called Alley Cat, which is basically a rip-off of the arcade game Hunchback, where you're running along the castle walls trying to get to the end. Now, Alley Cat is a lot simpler in that you haven't got the rope sections because you're a cat. And if you look at the graphics... It's almost identical to an earlier game by the same author from the same publishing house called Robin to the Rescue, which, you know, Robin Hood, Robin to the Rescue, fits nicely with the Hunchback style. And so you could quite clearly see that what he's done is he's released it once. Six months, a year later, they've asked him for another game. He's produced a new game in the form of Alley Cat.
Did you see, guys, that new game in production? Seems to be really, really, really cool. I don't remember actually the name. I have to search it.
You mean from Knights of Bytes or something?
Exactly, Knights of Bytes, yeah.
Yeah, Chester Colson. Chester Colson is resuming his game releasing stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Sam's Journey.
Hmm. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
I saw some videos on YouTube about the gameplay. Seems really amazing, and also seems it's not an 8-bit.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Seems like a 16-bit.
Yeah. Oh, it's looking very good, and I'm really impressed with the ideas they've got in there. Like the changing the hat and the outfit gives you different powers. I think that's a really cool feature. Hmm. We haven't really seen anything like that on the 64 before, so I'm looking forward to playing that one myself.
So you can see we are talking to two gaming experts. Silvio is on the cracking side with Hakuto Force and Andrew with his writing. So we are totally digging into games here.
Yeah, let's say I prefer to see the game cracked than play. Okay.
I like to use cracks occasionally if I want to get past a tricky part in a game or see more of it. So I'm grateful there are people out there cracking. And I think one of my favorite things, certainly in the last 10 years, is when groups have gone back to an old game, fixed up the bugs, put in new features, and have created a dual release. So you get the documents in the note file and this sort of thing. So you can go back to an old game and you actually get a new perspective on it. You know, if you've never seen the third level of the game, you can skip to the third level of the game and play it for the first time ever. If you've never understood how to activate a particular feature in the game, you've got the instructions there ready to read. So I think that's been a really good part of the scene.
Right. So we got a bit sidetracked here.
Yes, I think we should get back to Zemo. I have spent the last couple of days sort of looking back through some issues and looking at, just nostalgia, looking back at what we did and the issues we released. And it's sort of an interesting journey.
Of course, let's say in the past, when Hakuto Force is born, because... Okay, when say the date of the born of Hakuto Force, anyway, say 1986, 88, that's impossible, I don't remember that. Because we were at the beginning four or five friends that are swapping locally games and nothing more. When the with the internet, I started a real group because I can finally get in contact fastly with other fanatics of cracking, demo coding, and so on. Anyway, about the cracking that you asked me, during the golden era, there was the rush to get the first release. There is not much interest to put trainer on bug fixing or adding docs on other things like that, because there was the rush to be the first to release a cracked version of a game. Okay, now the things are changed, and in my honest opinion, it's better to put some effort and not only crack a game, but adding more stuff and get a simple crack more interesting and more appetizing for the public. That's what I think about now and about what the left cracking scene is what is trying to do. Yeah.
Right, so we got a bit sidetracked here.
Yes, I think we should get back to SEMO. I have spent the last couple of days sort of looking back through some issues and looking at, just nostalgia, looking back at what we did and the issues we released. And it's sort of an interesting journey. So, I mean, let's go back in time to the start of Scene World and talk about the first issue.
Oh, yeah, the first issue. Well, interesting is back then we still used the phone. As I said earlier, Silvio was calling me often and I was often calling to Andrew. So we used the phone a lot and we actually swapped disk arounds because I remember Andrew just had a set-top box for his television and he could only write like very small emails.
That's right, yes.
So it was like we were discussing by email what to do and by phone how to improve Scene World and how to make it more known and stuff. So because back then there was no CSDB or something. So we used a lot of old school communication here, and this was totally interesting, especially because everybody told us we are crazy to start a new disk mag in 2001. Nobody will ever be interested in that, and we will not surpass issue number 5. We will die with issue number 5. And,
well, actually, you know, I sat out the first issue. I didn't do anything for it. I had talked to Jurg over email and so on, and said, yeah, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. But with the first issue, I was doing stuff for different magazines at the time. I was doing stuff for, I think, Vandalism and Domination and whatnot. And when I mentioned Scene World to a lot of people, there was like a huge backlash from people being like, "Why are you wasting your time with that? Don't you know they're." You know, they're not going anywhere. And so when the first issue was coming along, I sort of sat back. I'm like, take care of the first issue. Let me see where this is going. And then we'll kind of pick it up from there. Because, there was just such loud noise from everybody when it was mentioned. And after the first issue, I was like, all right, this has some promise. So, you know, it's not just Jurg trying to do something and not being, because I had been in a group previously to that, Sonic Dreams, which was run by this guy who had good intentions, but he didn't know how to organize. Nothing ever got done because, you know, it just wasn't, we had a lot of good people in the group. You know, A Life in Hell was in the group and Mermaid and me and Fuzz, and it just, nothing was organized. And I was like, I don't want to do this again if this is what it's going to end up being. And after the first issue, I was like, all right, this has potential to go places. And so then I started contributing to it.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of what SceneWorld is down to Jörg's organization.
Being
persistent in contacting people, making sure things are done, and
being a pain in the ass.
Going back to that first issue, we had what I thought was a very unique design by Mac for the outfit, mm-hmm. in that, you know, designed to resemble a Windows startup screen. So you've got your icons, you've got the dock in the bottom right. So you've immediately got something to tie into. And of course, it was Macbeth who did the code. And again, very clever piece of coding, because all the essentials we needed were in there: the logo, the split for the screen to give you the separate text. And it worked really well.
On NTSC too.
Exactly.
And you had to reverse engineer all that code, because...
That's right, yes. It's issue two is probably one of the most memorable for me. We released issue one in February 2001, and Jörg had grand plans. Oh, we'll do 3-4 issues a year. And unfortunately, without the help of Macbeth, we didn't have any way of changing the menus and getting into the code to actually put together a new issue. So I had to sit there with an action replay, look in the monitor, look through memory, and find the block of memory for the menus and hacked it bit by bit. So I know if I take that bit out, I can put another letter in there. And, you know, so eventually I was able to create the menus for issue two like that. And I suppose then that was also when I started what I called my issue plans, which was basically a big piece of paper, names of the text split into sections, and I would tick and mark as I went along, this is ready, this isn't ready, this needs to be converted into Voodoo Nota, this is now moving into that chapter, and that sort of thing. So that's basically the system I used then to edit every issue from then. I'd have the piece of paper, so I'd roughly know how many texts were going in the issue and which chapters they were going in. And then I could, once we got back in touch with Macbeth, he gave us a small basic program that actually put the menus into memory. So it was much easier then. So all I had to do was edit the basic program and put the text in, run it, save out the block of memory, and you got your menus.
Awesome work, really. And also we should mention here, as Silvio mentioned and AJ earlier, at the beginning, feedback wasn't always positive. And I remember...
A pack of eaters. Yeah. Our pack of eaters from the issue one to the issue five, six. Now, what I remember that I found quite ridiculous was, okay, at the beginning, downwriting two. Okay, first issue, downwriting 2. Second issue, 2. Third issue, downwriting 2. Now, come on. We proved the loading system, the contents, the outfit, and you also rating 2. Ah, come on.
Yes. Yes, I remember since Silvio also did public relations and still does for SceneWorld, and running after people like, do your votes, we need votes, you know, votes. And so on. And at one
it worked.
Yes, and it still does. So still I'm telling Silvio, we need vote sheets. Please spread the news. We are going to release a new issue soon. So anyway, I remember at one place Silvio got enough and he was downvoting himself. I remember somebody at CSTB was asking Silvio.
I am the first to downvote myself. Yeah.
And then somebody was asking Silvio, do you downvote your own release because you think it's crap or for fun? And Silvio was answering, for fun, smiley face. Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, I think especially for you, Andrew, it must have been hard because, as you mentioned before, you cracked and reverse engineered the maxes, and then some people were just writing hate comments.
I mean, when you put a lot of work into something, it's never nice to get criticism.
Yeah.
Because you feel like, oh, why did I do it? But at the same time, even through, I mean, we've had multiple problems and controversies. I mean, issue two, we used a picture, sorry, issue three, we used a picture that actually belonged to Mermaid and was credited to the wrong person. And, you know, I can only apologize for that and what happened at the time. And again, unfortunately, it's Mermaid again. Creators promised us an intro for another issue and didn't deliver. We did get a music from her, but I used it in the intro rather than the mag. So she complained about using the long tune that was designed to be in the magazine while you're reading in the intro, which a lot of people were just going to skip past. So, I mean, yes, yeah, we have got some things wrong along the way.
Yeah, that's true.
But what we've always tried to do is we've tried to listen to some of that feedback. And you can see from the mag system today, there are a lot of new features in there that, since that first issue. I mean, obviously, we have to thank Cadaver for the fast loader, which he added in from issue 10, which obviously made a big difference to how people reacted to the magazine. But then there were other features we've added in as well. Initially, the scrolling was a fixed number of lines. Later, we added one line or a page at a time, so you could scroll through a little or a lot. We've changed fonts. We've added the music selector, so you can use the keyboard to jump straight to a particular music. We've added a choice of logos in each issue, which not many magazines have. And I think, you know, if you were to just compare the physical magazine and the outfit between issue one and when you see the new one, you'll see there is a lot of difference.
I especially like the color plant option where you can change color schemes, because I know Barracuda from Smash Designs and the stock, he told me is color blind. And I know AJ has also some color blindness. I think it was red green blindness.
Yeah.
Right? And so I thought, okay, we have implement something to people who are color blind to be able to read our magazine easier. So this is how we got the color blind option with the C key.
Yes, I like that as a feature. I mean, sometimes if your eyes are tired, it can be difficult to see particular colors to concentrate on a large amount of text. So by having the choice of colors, you can change color every now and then so your eyes rest a bit. Or if you're in a dark room, you can change it to one of the brighter options so you can see it better. So, you know, that is a useful feature.
So I guess none of you guys would have imagined that, that things would be different when we returned. Actually, we should mention that we had a break of 5 years, because at some point in September 2005, we had enough.
Yes, I mean, I think that was partly down to some of the criticism and partly down to various other things that are happening in life. During that break, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and which has obviously had a big effect on my life. And then,
how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. I had a major operation in September last year, and I'm still recovering from that, but the recovery is going well.
Okay, nice to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah, so I mean, that break from 2005 to 2010, you know, it seems like a long while, but in a lot of ways, I was glad we did carry on. And issue 16 was quite a special one in the history of Scene World, because Jörg traveled to England and we completed the issue ready for release here in England at my house, which was nice.
A surprise. Yeah, Andrew was surprising me. I know I was waking up one morning and he said, like, Jörg, I have a surprise for you. I was able to rescue the hard disk from my old laptop that still has all the data on it, including disc cover and finished intro and all the texts. And I already started with completing that stuff while you were still sleeping. So, well, in the next 3 days, we can put it out if you like. So, yeah. And And I remember when we released it on Commodore Scene Database, everybody was like, wow, Scene World is back, you know? And I guess thanks to this positive reaction, we all decided as a group to continue. I remember I was asking Silvio and AJ if you would like to rejoin the group, and everybody of you was like, yes, sure. No question about that. So,
no, because we had, I remember that the time of crisis when we lost some important important members to help us. But as for my personal group, when we had two major crises in my group, I think that you must try to resist, to search help somewhere else. If you don't have an important member, you can seek around, because I think there are anyway around the coders that can help. Because of course, you need coders to build the magazine. Without coder, you can do nothing. And you found some coders, and now we can go. Then we found other people to write articles. So I think we are going good again, and the dark past is over. Okay.
Well, I think also we've turned it into. At this point, it's not just the disc mag that the thing is. I mean, hell, we're talking on the podcast edition of it, you know. And there's, you know, we've got video interviews going up, and Jörg does his, or I'm sorry, you know, video reviews of stuff, and Jörg does his video interviews with people, and there's, you know, the web page, and so it's there's so much more to it now with so many more people contributing something.
Yeah, 21. Oh my God.
Yeah.
We started with 5 people, and I remember Andrew doing most of the stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, for a long while, it was there was a lot resting on my shoulders when it came to putting that final issue together. I mean, fortunately, we've got some good people in the group now who are taking some of that burden. I mean, obviously, I had to step back for a while because of my health problems, but... I've really enjoyed being involved again over the last couple of issues, just contributing some text and helping out where I can.
Well, I mean, it's not possible to be where we are now without the help of everybody, you know. And it's just amazing, because I know Silvio is very good in snowballing back bad. Bad opinion and saying something positive about it, you know. So yeah. I think Silvio was is the right guy for being public relation, because Silvio doesn't really allow you to take over the negativity, you know. So really, really a perfect team, I have to say. Yeah. It's interesting, because me as an organizer, I just had an idea what to do, and I didn't know how things would turn out myself. I just gave everybody a role that I thought would fit the best to him and say, okay, go for it. And now we try what works out. And it still works out. I mean, if you see in our internal Facebook group, what kind of discussions we have all the time, and if we should publish that article or change it, or if we should improve something, or for example, I always ask Silvio when people want to join us, should we let him? Does he have a good reputation in the demo scene, or is he a danger to the group harmony? You know, so there are a lot of things to consider.
Yeah, I'm sort of. A sort of KGB spy. Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's really a lot of things to consider. Yeah, I think we went through a lot of a lot of up and downs in the last 15 years, including, unfortunately, losing Lord Ronin as a member of a heart attack, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But so we really had everything from members joining us, leaving us, rejoining us, dying, whatever. Everything possible.
Lord Ronin was a great example of an enthusiastic Commodore fan, and he came to the computer quite late in his life, but he really enjoyed using the Commodore 64 in his everyday life, and he enjoyed writing about it as well. So, you know, it was great to have him on board as part of the Scene World team, and, you know, we do miss him.
Of course, seriously. I mean, we got diskettes of diskette images of text way in advance, like half year in advance. We already had text for the next 5 issues.
I've still got in my documents folder on here. I've got an email that I was planning to. He had sent me an email and I wrote a reply, but I didn't get around to sending it. And then he passed away, and it's still sitting there. I haven't sent it, obviously, because there's no one to send it to. But
same here. Well, I hope as we have this conversation now about video games as a sidetracking, maybe Silvio should recover his writings about video games.
Yeah,
that's my opinion.
Are you? No. Because. I think I'm not a good writer. I wrote in the past some article for Scene World, but I think I'm that's not exactly my role. Okay, to write.
Okay.
I prefer to do that that list to say what all the cracking game from all the group. In the actual scene, because I am on this topic, I follow strictly the cracking scene, so I know exactly who did what. Okay, and so I think that more than write an article, I prefer to stay focused on to write down that list.
Okay.
If it's okay for you, of course.
Yeah. I was just thinking of as we played so nice together, Andrew and you especially, on the new gaming topic. I thought
it's tough to write stuff that you're not really, you know, you're not up on. You know, like I was doing the NTSC news for God knows how long, and the thing is
14 years?
Yeah, well, more or less, yeah.
More than 10 years, yeah.
But and the thing is that I don't. There's a lot of people that I know from the NTSC scene, and it becomes difficult in that, like, what's news or what's just things that my friends are doing, you know? And a lot of stuff I don't know anything about because my involvement is fairly restricted to these people that I know, and other stuff, this peripheral information, I don't ever hear of. So when, you know, when I'm doing it and it's like, well, this and this may have happened, and then Kevin Castiles comes along. He's like, "No, wait, this thing was released, and then this thing is over here, and that happened over there." Because he's got he's watching what's happening, and I just, you know, I'm looking at what two guys that I know are doing over there, and that's my NTSC scene. That's what I know of it, you know. And so it's tough to really write something that.
Sure.
I mean, that was my least favorite thing in the world to do, was write the NTSC news, because no one would tell me anything, and. You know, then it was, how do I fill up an article with one thing that happened?
Well, I'll take you back a few years to when I was involved in the rock and roll disc mag from Raiders of the Lost Empire Roll. And I wrote a text about what was happening in Britain, about what was happening in the UK. And I made the mistake of saying that there wasn't very much happening and there was only a couple of people active. And, of course, I then got... shot down in flames because everyone's saying, oh, but you've forgotten about this, and you, what are you talking about? This person is active, and this person's just done this. And so, you know, I totally feel what you're saying there, AJ.
All right. Yeah, so Silvio is staying with the cracking list. No problem.
Cracking is in my heart, okay?
I do like to see, you know, I do like to see the cracking list, the sort of, you know, the what's going on. I know one or two other disc mags also have their equivalent, and we've got the Game Quarterly mag now that collates that information. But, you know, I would like to see some information about the cracking scene stay in Scene World as part of what we're covering.
Sure. Silvio will do that. I'm pretty sure about that. He already told me that it's perfect that that the next issue is coming out soon. So,
And that's impressive how many all the crackings there are still today.
Mm.
Because I was thinking that the cracking scene was not won't last so much time. Instead, I saw there are also new groups that can surface and start to do all the cracking. Also, there are interesting what's the name? Excuse me. Rare stuff. Okay, there are if you notice on CSDB, a lot of rare games are coming up. Games that, for example, Daffy Duck.
Yes. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, that's I think it's the greatest example actually.
But that wasn't CSDB. That was games that weren't.
Yes, I'm actually involved in the games that weren't projects.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Games that were. So we have, for example, other strong group like Laxity that can dig out incredible rare stuff.
They've found. Yeah, they found three or four recently, haven't they? And released.
Hmm.
Really interesting.
So, yeah. Well,
stuff. There is a lot of activity in cracking scene. That's surprising me too. Okay.
Well, actually, I think the cracking scene also, you know, as you said before, the focus has changed from being just the first to get a release out to now the one that fixes it the best, which is really. It kind of keeps the whole thing alive because there were some lousy games, and now they can fix those issues. You know, I tried to code a couple of games way back in the day, and I could never figure out how to do certain things, and so I just kind of gave up on it. I should just release them and let the cracking games pick it up and fix my errors and release the final game.
I think Scene World is the reason, maybe I'm wrong, but I think Scene World is the reason that now everybody is proud that his game is NTSC fixed and working, you know?
Yes. And there is also to show the skillness
of
the one able to fix it, because this is a really important part. I am able to fix it. I am able to train in that way. Okay.
Yeah. And I remember 2001 when I started Scene World. Everybody was like, "Oh, NTSC is dead." Nobody cares about it anymore. So why do you want to put the time and the energy in NTSC fixing it? And now games are NTSC tested and NTSC fixed right from stock without cracking, actually.
And the interesting thing is that has happened while we all have access to better and better emulators. So in many ways, we don't actually need to fix it for the real hardware because we can run it in the emulator. But I think a lot of people do like the challenge of fixing it for NTSC, fixing it for different hardware. I mean, we've seen a lot of games fixed for IE or Easy Flash to give you that better access for it. And, you know, as Silvio says, having the skills to do that is important. We're keeping skills alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And there is, you know, there is hardware that is, you know, we just saw the review of the 64 Reloaded, which is a new, you know, it's a new motherboard for it. And granted, the chips are going to be old because they don't make them anymore. But, you know, but it's a new motherboard that people can order. And there's become a market now for new hardware, in as much as you can get new hardware. You know, with this thing, there's a Commodore 65 thing that they're supposed to be coming out with soon.
Yes, and Mega 65, yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming out this year, yes.
I'd be curious to know how that does, because...
Yeah, I invited them to the podcast, probably maybe for March or April. I already talked to them.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems like I can dig that if it's, you know, it's got the 64 compatibility, but then you get into the whole, the 65 mode is, you know, the native mode. That's a whole new platform, and there's currently nothing for it. So what's going to encourage people to do anything with it, other than the fact that they can?
Yes, I mean, the C65 was very interesting when the details first started to emerge in 1993, 1994. A lot of people were assuming it was just going to be a budget Amiga console rather than an enhanced Commodore 64. And it does sit between the two because you've got the higher graphic resolution, more colors on the C65. But from what people have said and what I've read about it, I've seen one in the flesh once at a computer show. There is a completely different style of programming for it because of the different graphic modes for the VIC-free chip is very different to what has gone before.
Yeah. So it's an interesting. It's a brand new. It would be like bringing out like the Plus 4 or something now, where it's a totally different platform that things don't work on. And you know, I would love to mess with it, and I would love to see what it can do, but. At the same time, most modern hardware, or all modern hardware, I can say, can probably, you know, outrun that thing, outpace that on just about anything. So what's going to encourage people to do anything for it?
But then if you take a look at how quickly the C64 DTV was hacked, so people could add extra stuff, could add extra games to it, and then there was several new demos and other things that took advantage of the hardware. So there is a will and an interest in doing that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Plus, I mean, if you look at the mini game competitions, there's still a lot of people interested in really getting down to the metal, right down to the core of the machine, getting something done in a small amount of space for the challenge of it, for the real hardcore skill of it.
Mm-hmm. Jürgen and I were discussing the other day about how. You know, what are the practical reasons for having any knowledge of assembly language or anything these days?
And, yesterday, actually.
Yeah. And I just recently saw a thing from NASA that they were trying to hire somebody with assembly language skills because the Voyager probes that they launched in 76, I think, need to be reprogrammed, and that uses assembly language.
I mean, there was a story last year about hardware hackers literally hacking into a satellite and upgrading the firmware. So I mean, there are skills, and there is still hardware out there. I mean, I've heard several stories about Commodore 64s still in use. The famous one is the Australian bus station that was using it to show timetables. There's something I saw today on Facebook. A Commodore 64 was used as the computer in a public weighbridge where they weighed vehicles. And so it applies to a lot of hardware, actually. There is still a lot of older hardware out there that is running software, that is running applications that people are still using and haven't got the time, the money to upgrade and keep running.
Plus, there are also embedded systems, too.
Absolutely.
That might not be a full computer, but, you know, someone's got to program that refrigerator.
Mm. And also, it's a way of thinking. If you're the logical type, if you're the scientific type, you're going to understand the process of programming, I think, a lot more than someone who's come from an artistic background. And so I think if they're looking for someone who's got that skill set, even if they're not actually asking for someone to go in and program a Commodore 64. And in fact, I think a few years ago, I think it's mid-80s, there was a Commodore 64 being used by NASA on one of their observation flights, which they used to do for star tracking. There was an American who was using a Commodore 64 to log the data from the star tracking. So, you know, yet again, a real-life application.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of stuff. There was a school in Michigan, I think, that was still using an Amiga 500, I think, to run all the to turn the heat on and turn the lights on and everything every day.
Yes, I've read that too. Yeah.
And they just replaced it. They kept finding parts on eBay, but they finally just this year decided that they're going to replace it.
Yeah, I hear in some Russian station they use the Evil Spectrum. Or yeah. For about the schematics of the train arrivals, departures, and so on. Because if I remember correctly, in the east side of Europe, the Spectrum was much stronger than the Commodore 64, which was more for the western part of Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the main reason was there were several countries that actually blocked imports of computers and expensive electronic gear, or it was very limited in the places it was available, and they tended to be government stores that were very expensive. So it was only the very rich who could afford a brand new computer from the West, and so that did limit it in a lot of countries. The Spectrum is an interesting one because in Russia and several other Eastern European countries, there were clones that worked in a very similar way. They weren't exactly the same hardware, but there are variations on the basic Spectrum, and they've continued to be developed. And again, people are still enjoying the challenge of going back to it and coding for it and producing new software for it.
You had that. That was an English designer or a UK-ish.
That's correct. Yes, Sir Clive Sinclair.
Yeah.
He came up with what was the first machine he came up with was called the ZX80 in 1980. He previously was the first one to do in this country to do a digital watch and then a digital calculator, and he continued working on electronics. He did the ZX80, which had 1K of RAM, 1K of ROM. So very primitive. The ZX81 was the follow-up, again, 1981. And so in 1982, the same year the Commodore 64 launched, the Sinclair ZX Spectrum launched, and that was a color computer then compared to the previous two, which are black and white. And, yeah, so, I mean, that's been an important part of computer, particularly the computer games in the UK. There's a lot of companies now being run by the people who grew up programming on the Spectrum.
You had a lot of cool things over there that weren't too big. We had, you know, the C64 and the Apple II and that, you know, basic generic stuff, but you had the Spectrum, the ZX. My brain still wants to say ZX because I'm a dork. But there was the Spectrum, and you had the BBC Micro.
Yes. And yeah, that's right.
You had all these kind of cool little kind of exclusive things. I don't think other European countries didn't have their own sort of market, did they?
Not so much. I mean, Philips in Holland did produce...
Schneider in Germany.
That's correct. Did produce its range of machines. It licensed the Odyssey console from the US, and that did well in Europe for a while. But really, we had a sort of a mini boom here in 1982, 1983, where there were several new machines all came out at once. So there was the Apricot, the Dragon.
The Dragon. Yeah.
Several other machines, all based around the same sort of 8-bit hardware. And unfortunately, a lot of people talk about the US video game crash in 1983 when prices dropped and Atari...
buried E.T.
supposedly buried E.T. Here in the UK, because we had all these various computers. Yes, there were casualties and some of the smaller companies fell apart, but we had the home computers and there was much more interest in the computer than the console because it could do more than just play games. So I think that helped us get over the crash quicker. And as I say, it's really set the foundations for the industry as it is today, because so many people could quite quickly make a game, publish it on tape themselves, and all right, they didn't make a fortune, but they did, you know, they were able to achieve something quite quickly, and that inspired them.
I wonder if there was something in Italy, because the only Italian company I know of is Olivetti or something.
Commodore.
Who did printers?
Yeah, exactly, Olivetti. It was a great industry in Italy. And then, of course, the government. It was a really good industry, Olivetti.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it ties into the story of the BBC Micro that was formed by the British Broadcasting Corporation, which is our public broadcaster here, responsible for television and radio. They saw the growth in computers and wanted to have a computer literacy program so more people were interested in using computers and, you know, knew how to use them. So they put out a contract for a computer that everyone could use. The end result was the BBC computer produced in Cambridge. And from that company, which is also known as Acorn, they produced then later machines, the Acorn Archimedes. And in developing the Acorn Archimedes, they produced the first RISC processor, RISC. Acorn actually had some investment from Olivetti to keep them going through hard times. And then from Acorn came ARM, Advanced Research Machines. And they're responsible for a lot of the chips you find around you today. So in your mobile phones.
My iPhone.
Your iPhone. They're all based on RISC technology.
Wow.
A lot of people don't realize the ARM chips, that's the Acorn RISC machine. Is I think what originally stood for. So yeah, it's in everything, and they're very quiet about it too. You don't hear too much about it. It's just like, oh yeah, it's an ARM chip, but you don't. When it's Intel, it's like, yo, Intel is stickers on everything, but ARM is just kind of like ARM is in everything.
Well, I mean, I doubt if many people know that it was actually a British guy who invented the transistor. So, you know, we came up with the basis for much of the electronic and computer revolution, but they didn't patent it, didn't seek to make money out of it.
You mean it wasn't aliens?
Area 51.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all recovered crash material.
So, oh my God, we've covered a whole history lesson here about Olivetti, about the British companies. Oh my God.
Well, it's cool because we see so many different sort of backgrounds in all of these areas. When we talked to Lobsang in our second podcast, that was in Peru, and it was such a weird kind of. He identifies with PAL, but the whole thing down there was so different from everywhere else. You know, they were cracking games and then selling them, putting their own protection on games. They were copy protecting their own cracked games and then selling them to people. You know, and then there were other cracking groups trying to crack the cracked games. Like it's such a weird kind of everybody has this little microcosm that they grew up with that's totally different.
Right. In Peru, there was a Twin Eagle group.
Twin Eagles group. Yeah. Lobsang Alvitus, Mr. Byte.
Yeah. And there's such a, you know, the UK had all these, you know, different machines that were told that you know, as an American, you hear about them, you know, the ZX Spectrum and you know, the BBC Micro, you hear about this stuff, but you never get to see one because they don't live here.
Yeah.
It's kind of a cool thing to see because all of us, we're from different areas, you know, Italy, Germany, UK, the US. We all kind of have this sort of different kind of like foundation, and yet it all kind of ends up in the same place.
Well, yeah, I think that's a big part of why Scene World is as it is, because we all have our own different perspective on life, on computers, on what we do with the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. And putting it all together creates something unique.
Oh, yes, I remember when we got this article from the Argentinian guy, and he was writing an article about the Treen Z64. Uh-huh. And Andrew was like, Treen? That must be a typo. I think he meant Treen.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, at that point, I knew nothing about it. But, I mean, in recent years, I found out more about it. Thanks to the internet, you got the research out there. And it's fascinating. I mean, I have on the hard drive, I have the unfinished manuscript of a new book, which has a heck of a lot of research in it about different countries in the world, about how their Commodore 64 experience was different.
Wow. Yes.
I remember when I was a kid here in Italy, there was the main fight was a 64s against versus Spectrum. Okay, then I remember when other kids come out to say, "Well, I have an MSX, I have an Amstrad." What? Mm-hmm. What the fuck is that? Because in Italy there was mainly 64 and Spectrum, and the others machine, and I think that both Amstrad and MSX was really good machines. But there wasn't good spread inside among the kids of these years here in Italy. So nobody knows what they are talking about, because nobody knows what an MSX or Amstrad was in those times. Well, there was a funny times anyway. I remember those stupid fight against the 64s versus Spectrum.
You see, I wasn't when I got my 64. I wasn't even cognizant that it was a thing. We had in school we had Apple IIs, and that was the really big. Everything was an Apple II, and then we had in the one school we had a room of just a couple of Macs, and this is 86. So these are very very early Macs, and I remember thinking how cool those were, and that's kind of what I wanted. And then I kept bugging my family, you know, I want to get this and want to get this. And they went and got a C64, which you could get, you know, you could go to a toy store, Toys R Us, and they've got them, you know, on the shelves there. You just, any mass market store, you know, they didn't sell them at computer stores. They sold them in department stores and stuff. So you go to, you know, the local Bradley's, which has, you know, it's all clothes and stuff. And then over in the corner, there's a C64 for sale. So they got that. And I remember looking at it and being like, well, what the hell is this? And then, you know, it ended up being, it was still always kind of, and I guess this isn't how it was in most of the rest of the country, because everybody else on the planet seems to have one as well. But where I was, everyone was like, when I'd say it, they were like, Commodore 64, what the hell is a Commodore 64? Nobody knew what it was. And this is right in the heart of when it was popular the most, you know? And I ended up using that because that's what I had. And, you know, learned from that, but when I got it, I didn't know what it was. It was just this brown thing that came out of a box, and I'm like, okay. That was my first thought. I remember looking at it and being like, it's brown.
poor commie.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Silvio mentioned the Amstrad, which was another British machine, and it's quite interesting because that was very popular in France. And there was a lot of companies in France, you know, the big international company now, Ubisoft, was originally a French company. And the Amstrad was the machine they made their first games for and built the company on. And then went around swallowing up other companies until they grew really big. And the MSX, started in Japan with Microsoft money behind it, supposedly trying to set a standard that other manufacturers could make. So there was different companies making the same machine, rather like what would happen with the 3DO console in later years. And again, that was very big in Holland, but it wasn't very big in the UK. So it's interesting, these regional differences just within Europe. And I think that also then reflects some of the world experience in that, yes, the Americans were big on the Apple II, but the Japanese were big on the NEC PCs and those machines.
And now Commodore's back again with another smartphone. What do you guys think of that? What's your opinion on the... Jörg just sent it to me. I'm going to be getting it in a day or two to look at it. And
I guess more a week or two.
But I thought you said it was 48 hours.
No, that was not our postal service. That would have been TNT.
Well, I mean, there's two sides to it. There's the recognition of the name, which is never going to be as strong now as it used to be. And then there is, you know, the nostalgia side of it. Yes, it's good to see a new item with the Commodore brand on it, but is it really going to make a difference to the market? And I can't see, given the competition from people like Samsung and Apple, that it's going to make any significant dent in the market.
You know, my opinion on that is I don't... the way that they made it seem was that they're not trying to be Commodore. They're trying to honor Commodore by using the name, but they're not trying to be the old school Commodore. So they're trying to do what Commodore would do if they were still alive. And, you know, if that's the case, more power to them. But time will tell how it works out. And I don't see it making a huge dent in the market because Android and iOS or rather Samsung and Apple are so entrenched as the leaders in this that you can have other phone companies and they might do well for themselves, but they're never going to be the market leader in this. So what's your opinion on the new Pet phone? What do you think of that thing?
Silvio, you must be all for it. You are Italian.
Yeah.
What's your opinion about the Commodore Pet phone from Commodore Italy?
No, they're from the UK, remember. They've got a UK address.
Well, but they are Italians.
Okay, I haven't got it in my hand. Technically, I am not so much interested to have such a phone because I think that to take... any phone of the next generation you put inside an emulator, more or less it's the same. I think it's difficult to play a game on an iPhone. So if I own an iPhone or other phone with Android, so I am not so interested about that to buy that kind of phone. Nevertheless, I hope that they can go on with this with the selling. Well, I cannot translate exactly what I have, what I want to say. So I am not interested in the project. On the other hand, I am not totally against the project. Okay.
No, yeah, I understand you completely. You know, it's an issue where it's not something that, like I said, it's not going to change the market. You know, more power to them if they want to try to do something with it and you know, build a company and so on. That's fantastic. But you know, I don't know that it needed to be Commodore. It could have been anything. It could have been, you know, Massimo's phone company, and that would have been just as good. You know, because
I think that the world of Commodore is. Took active thanks more to all the emulators, because of course people don't have the hardware anymore, but download an emulator, can think about the past and take again the hobby to play, to code, to crack, to compose music, draw graphic, etc., etc.
Do you think it's a waste of time, a waste of money?
No. In my opinion, it's an hobby. So an hobby, it's not something useless or unproductive. It's an hobby. So work on X64 is just for fun. Someone collect stamps, author build ships in the battle, and we are stuck on the 64. I think that's something really normal. It's a hobby, like other kind of hobby. And also, I see that in Italy there are a lot of people still interested in 64 and to collect all the tapes that I don't know how to describe them, because there in the past here in Italy there was not a law against piracy. Okay, so some people took game, changed the name in Italian with Italian names, with change name to lives, score, and so on, and they sell publicly in place here in Italy without any problem against the law. And there are a lot of people that collect this kind of recracked stuff. That's I personally don't like it, because at the 90% are all freezed, and when something is freezed, it's not good. But there are people that is interested also in cross hardware, for example to connect the driver, the old driver to PC to transfer game, and then to play it on the real thing, the original. There are people that aren't on eBay here in Italy to find the original hardware. So I can say here in Italy there was a lot of activity, not scene activity, but activity around this hobby. And it's good for me anyway.
It's actually true. That's something that that AJ and I mentioned all the time, that especially in the last 5-6 years, a lot of retro activity and interest came back.
Oh,
and
Lord,
everybody
yeah.
wants That's... to relive his past.
Yeah, well, we've seen that, you know, like we were saying before, with the new hardware that is old hardware, and they've remade there's some South American company, I think, making Sega Master Systems, and
yes, Tech Toy.
Yeah,
Tech Toy.
Yeah. I mean, there's all this nostalgia, right? That's huge right now. So it's making a market for this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I write for Retro Gamer magazine here in the UK, and you know, so that's what I like, and that's what I'm interested in. But even then, if you look beyond that, you can see services like Xbox Live Arcade and the PlayStation Network. You can see old games coming back again. An old franchise is being revived because people are still interested in them.
It's like CinemaWare. Yeah, true. Yeah. So from what I gather, from what I gather is Silvio, you think they are coming in the right time with that pet phone, because people are interested in playing their old games. And that on a smartphone is just perfect. Not for the demo scene, but for the everybody guy. the next door.
Yeah, but if you talk about those devices like iPhone, these are not good for me to play.
Touchscreen inputs, yeah, awful. Yeah,
I don't get why the people install emulators on those devices. Because, okay, if you take this device and you watch a demo, for me, okay, that's okay. But to play a game on an iPhone or with this phone or from new technology, I don't know if it's good to play, okay? I am more interested to play on a PC with a good emulator, with I can press the key, or I can interface a joystick. But on those new phone, I have doubt you can play good as you would.
It's tough, you know, translating any game to a phone. I cannot get into playing a game on my phone, aside from, like, you know, what is it that I play? Andrew, help me out here. Hanging with friends and stuff. You know, it's like small things like that, little time waster games I can play because there's not too much to it. But then I go on there and I see that there's, you know, Grand Theft Auto is available on your iPhone. How the hell do you play that? Now my hands are not small hands, and so if I'm trying to play this, just having my fingers on the screen, I'm blocking half the damn screen. And like Silvio said, you know, you're not able to interface with the thing. There's no keyboard controls, there's no controller. There's nothing like that. So you're sitting there trying to use whatever they give you on the screen or just kind of swiping or moving, and it just makes it so painful to do anything. I can only imagine, especially with an emulator on that. Good God.
Well, I was lucky enough to get for my 40th birthday a JXD gaming tablet, which runs the Android operating system. But the good thing about it is it's got traditional buttons and joysticks. So it looks very similar to the PlayStation PSP. And you've got the dual analog sticks either side of the screen. You've got a diamond of action buttons on the right and a traditional D-pad cursor on the left. And so for playing games, for emulated games, that is really good because you've got the direct feel of the buttons and the joypad under your hand, and you can reconfigure the different buttons. So if you have got a game that uses a keyboard control as well, you can change a button to be that keyboard control for you. So, I mean, that's a great way to play older games on the go. And it is then also a standard Android device, so you can upload modern Android games on it. So, I mean, that seems to be a good compromise between the two. But as you say, trying to play, let's take an example at random, a game like Whizball on the phone, on a touchscreen phone, would be almost impossible because of the way the controls work. But if you've got the physical input, it's much easier. It's much better. So I think for a lot of those phones, what you need to be playing is a game that's designed for touchscreen controls.
Right. Mm-hmm. That does that. I'm pretty good as Pac-Man.
Yes, I mean Pac-Man is a good example of something you can play.
Right.
But even then, it has to be a sensitive control. And I mean, what I did find interesting was the recent Pac-Man 256, which is based on the infamous kill screen in the original arcade game where the graphics
yes, I saw that. Corrupt. Yeah.
And so the idea is you're guiding Pac-Man through the maze and the screen is corrupting around you, chasing you up the screen. So it becomes like a race. So that is an example of how you can tailor the experience for the smartphone for the different style of control.
You know,
Crystal Castle, I remember you can play it with the paddle. So maybe with touch screen, maybe it's possible. I don't know. Still, I think that is not a good device to play games on a mobile device, Android, on iPad, whatever, on iPhones, excuse me, iPhone or Android, whatever. It's not a good device to play games or emulate games.
See, and the other good part about emulators that, you know, I've gotten into now is that the 64 has a very large library of games. But, and it had a lot of controllers, a lot of joysticks and stuff that you could use. And Jörg and I have discussed this. Apparently, it did have the option for a second button. But no games ever used a second button. And so, for platforming...
Except Chase HQ 2 on the C64 game station.
Yeah, well, but...
That used the second button for a boost.
Mm-hmm. And there were some games, some decent-looking games and decent-acting games on the 64, but it was not great for platforming because your brain wants to use the regular old Mario controls. D-pad on the left, jump, and what an action on the right. And for most of these, it's move the joystick left to right and jump is up. And it's just an unnatural thing. And with the emulator, I can use a regular old D-pad controller, and I can remap it so that that button is up, you know, so that then I can jump properly, and it's not painful. But I remember playing them on an actual 64 with a big-ass joystick on the side there, trying to, like, you know, make my little guy move around, and it was murder because it's just not a natural... You know, well, I guess none of this is actually natural because, you know, we didn't evolve with controllers in our hands. But but it's just, it's counterintuitive to everything you kind of learn playing games.
Now, that's interesting because, I mean, I started playing games on the computer, so I was used to the joystick first and then had to adjust to using a joypad. So I found at first it felt unnatural for me to be using my left hand to do the directions and the right hand then was doing the fire. I was so used to it being the other way around. The right hand was on the joystick and the left hand was using the button on the stick. So it was completely the other way around. But I found over time, you know, I can play both. I can still do both. And it's interesting. I think, you know, again, it's what you were used to at first is your brain almost maps to it in that sense.
Well, I was lucky enough to have both at 5 years old. I had an NES Game Boy, and not Game Boy. Game Boy was later. I had an NES and a Commodore 64. So,
I'm horribly spoiled now in that I've gotten so used to being able to map the joystick however I like it when I was at a video game con in September, I sat down to play Pac-Man. And I did it. I had the controller upside down, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't make it move because the way it was the stick in the middle and then the button. And I'm so used to mapping it so that the button's on the left because I'm left-handed and I want it to be a certain way. I'm holding it wrong because that's where the button should be, over there on mine, you know. But it's not on this thing.
Well, it's quite funny. I added an Atari 2600 to my collection last year, and because of the famous Atari 9-pin joystick port, I've actually been using a Cruiser joystick that I got from my Commodore 64 on the Atari. And it feels completely different to be using that joystick to using a standard Atari joystick.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then in reverse, I can use the Atari paddles on my Commodore 64.
That's I used to use a Sega Master System controller because it's got the same plug. Mm. Although Jörg tells me I could have blown up my 64, but that never
yes.
happened.
Yes, Andrew actually gave me the description and the circuit board.
Yes, that's right.
Manual on how to solder an adapter. I think Andrew knows more about that.
Yes, that's right. The input from the joystick ports goes direct into the CIA chip, the complex interface adapter chip, and because of the different way that the Master System and the Mega Drive pad are wired up, if you push the wrong button, you make a connection across two of the pins, and that sends a charge down to the wrong bit of the CIA chip, and it can fry it. So
I lucked out, I guess.
You did, yeah.
But then I think there's a difference between some C64 models, because some had like protection diodes.
Yes, protection. Yes, that's right.
I don't know what the word is.
Well, it's a resistor, basically.
Resistant, yeah, resistor.
That stops the current going back on that line. It's one of the differences between the original C64 and what we would now call a cost reduced version, the C64C.
That's what I had. I had the 64C.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you see that because they went back to the original diagrams and used cheaper components, in the end it was actually different.
Mm.
So
That is why AJ didn't damage his C64.
That could be why.
I know the SID sounded like crap on that thing. It had no filters.
Well, it had, but it had fixed this problem that
The fact that we had filters to begin with was a bug, and they fixed that bug. But in fixing it, it broke all these things that used them.
Yeah, they went back to Bob Yannis' original schematics and specifications for the SID chip. And wanted to make a new version using a new ceramic chip rather than the original metal chip, which was cheaper for them to produce. And when they did it, what happened was that they then reduced the background noise on the chip, so the standard sort of electronic noise you get in a circuit. And so by doing that, that then caused the samples on a C64 to play quieter than they would on an original 64. So that's where you hear the big difference. And if you actually look in the C64C user manual, they've left out some of the information on the SID chip. So it doesn't tell you about ring modulation and synchronization, where you can actually put two SID channels together.
Oh, that's information I didn't had before.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there are some early models of the C128, the Commodore 128, that have the original SID chip, the 6581. And then later on, and particularly in the D and the DCR model, they all have the new 8580 chip. So you could hear a completely different sound depending on which chip is being used.
Yeah, that's actually true. I have a C128 flat, but with different chips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still have a flat 128. It's in a box. I haven't used it in a long time. But I've got I used to have a 128D. That was a machine.
It looked like a workplace computer, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. it was nice. I actually liked that computer a lot, except the keyboard kept going crappy.
Yeah, the ribbon connector wasn't ideal.
Well, no, it was the contacts were going.
All right.
And what ended up happening was like two, three times a day, I'd have to take it apart and clean everything and put it back together just to be able to use it. I'd be sitting there banging on keys, trying to make them work. And it was terrible. That's what ended up making me end up with a Mac, was because I just couldn't do anything on the 128 anymore. And despite the fact that it has a switchable keyboard, you just plug it into the side. It's separate. God help you if you're trying to find one.
Now there's eBay.
Yeah.
Do you guys have original hardware? I know Jörg still have it.
Sure. Sure.
Yes. I've got quite a collection of old machines upstairs. As Jörg knows from having visited.
Sorry, I dropped something. So repeat, Andrew.
Yeah. So as Jörg knows, having visited and spent some time in the room, I have a separate room for my computer collection. So I've got several different machines, and I've still got some working C64 hardware in there.
I've got my flat 128, but I've got nothing to. I don't have anything to plug into it. I have no drives. I have no monitor. I don't have anything. All I've got is the computer and a power supply. So it's in a box until I can find some time to track down peripherals.
Something to do this year.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at this new, the 1541 Ultimate. That thing looks pretty decent. That would alleviate my need to actually have a disk drive.
Oh, that's really good. I managed to get mine, and it's fantastic, because not only is it incredibly easy to use on the 64, I find it's just so simple to transfer stuff backwards and forwards between the PC. Because you can just plug. I've got a little USB drive, pen drive I use on the Ultimate, and just, you know, plug it straight into the PC, drag and drop the files across.
It's like we've gotten to a point in computer technology, even with the 64, in that it used to be when you'd get a new piece of hardware for it, it was brutal to use because you had to figure out all these commands and crap like that. Now, we just saw with Kevin's review of the Wi-Fi modem, it's the easiest thing in the world to do. It's a couple minutes of setup. You plug it in and you do this and do that and you're good. And with this thing, the Ultimate, you plug it in, you put in your flash drive, and you're good to go. And it's finally gotten to the point now where the things that you can get, the add-ons for it, are not harder to use than the original hardware.
Yeah, it's not an Action Replay that you have to learn how to use first. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Which is great, because that's the kind of thing that always, you know, I had the 128 with the 1200 baud modem, and I had a couple of different things. There were ways to connect to the internet through geos, I want to think. Maybe it was Wheels, the bastard child of geos. But there are ways to do it. There was a web browser they made for it, and there was different stuff. But again, God help you if you actually wanted to do it, because, you know, logging on and figuring out the TCP IP stacks and this and that, it was all manual crap that you had to do. It wasn't just like connect and you go. It was, you know, you've got to, you know, pull out, you know, reams of documentation.
I can remember going to a computer event in Birmingham at the National Exhibition Center, which is this really big convention center, and the magazine Micromart was putting on a computer fair, and they designated one corner of it as the retro area, because the magazine had a regular retro column even back then, and this is more than 10 years ago. And so I was there with some friends setting up the Commodore 64, so we had various machines up and running. We had a special demonstration pod with Bombmania, the four-player game from Classical Games. Which is now part of ProtoVision. And right next to it was a brand new Xbox demonstration pod. And during the day, that Xbox pod failed three or four times, but the Commodore 64 kept running. But I mean, the story obviously is about connecting to the internet. The editor of the magazine came over and was talking to us for a while. And it was on a Saturday afternoon, so everyone wanted to know what the soccer scores were. So we tried to use Geos and the modem to log on to the internet to try and get the football scores. And, of course, the speed at which the pages were coming down the line was just so slow.
Yeah.
And with the browser in Geos, you'd get large rectangles, rather like when you get a missing image these days where you get the little cross in the middle. You just get the box with image written in it, and you then have to click it and download the image and then load it into a separate program or desk accessory to actually see it.
Yep.
So, I mean, how far we've come now, as you say, with the new Wi-Fi modem.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing.
No, I have a little question to AJ.
Yes.
What do you think about the start of rebranding the Commodore 64 from Commodore USA to create the strange stuff that it's a PC with the shape of the Commodore 64? Oh. With
inside
device,
it's you know, there's so many little knockoffs that they do, and it's,
yeah, I agree.
I get that there's a nostalgia value to it, and okay, it's coolish looking, but for the price that they were asking for what was essentially a budget PC in a box that looked like a 64, no.
Yeah,
you know, I'm all for keeping everything like the 64 Reloaded, which is the motherboard, and they've got the new cases that they're making that work with it, and you can put that all together. That's fine, because it keeps the thing the way it is. But to make something that calling it a Commodore 64 and making a completely different machine and then releasing it as that. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's an emulator on it, too. But no, that doesn't count. That's not a 64. That's just something that looks like one. Yeah. Well, everyone's so bent on somehow cashing in on the Commodore name. There's so many, you know, and like we said before, it's not, at this point, the name recognition isn't going to be there anymore, you know, because that it's in the past. The company hasn't been solvent since 1994, but you got guys coming out with, you know, first it was the Webbit, and that was a piece of crap, and then there was something else, and that was a piece of crap. There was the DTV, but that wasn't really a Commodore thing. That was, you know.
No, it's a totally different thing.
Right. And that was decent. But then there was that thing that you mentioned before that looks like a 64, but it's really just a budget. It's a laptop component PC, you know, and so now every couple of years, someone comes back, you read the headlines, Commodore is back with something yeah. new. And it's like, Commodore is not back. This has nothing to do with Commodore. It's some dude that just bought a picture, you know, he bought the rights to use the chicken head on his device. And that's what, he's just trying to make a buck off of it. But it's not, the Commodore isn't back.
Anyway, the thing that was happening before the DTV is actually the Commodore 1, which was the reverse-engineered FPGA-based Commodore motherboard.
Yes.
At ATX.
That wasn't crap though. That was Jerry. That was
That was Jerry Ellsworth. Yeah.
But again, she didn't get like the rights to use Commodore. It was the C1. It was sold similarly to like the C64 Reloaded, you know. It's kind of a thing for hobbyists that want to do it. It wasn't like they started up a new Commodore and tried to release a computer.
No, that's true.
No, more interesting is all the cross hardware to interface all the Commodore device to a PC, for example.
Yeah, true.
It's you couldn't bring Commodore back at this point because it's so far removed from what everything else was that it's just, you know, it's gone, and that's okay. It's all right to be gone.
Starting a Kickstarter project,
right.
Bring back Commodore.
Right. But, you know, that's the thing. It's like there's no point to bringing back Commodore because if it was around and it had evolved with everything else, then that would make sense. That would be okay, and it would be relevant today. But as of, you know, I mean, technically, the 64 is frozen at 1982. Mm. What 1982 Commodore 64 is the same as 1994 Commodore 64.
Mm.
So
I tell you what will happen. Massimo Conicciani will be sued by.
Wasn't
the
he already
holding?
Wasn't someone already filing a lawsuit against him?
Yes, they're already starting it. Yeah. So, and then Commodore with the patch phone will be history.
Well,
that's just a matter of time.
Well, his response was that because none of these other Commodores ever did a smartphone, then they were therefore allowed to do a smartphone. I don't know if that works legally, but you know, I mean, I don't see the harm in using the name because there's no name recognition anymore. Nobody cares, and whoever owns the copyright is not. What are you going to do with that copyright? There's no way. You're not going to make money on the future by holding on to the Commodore 64 copyright. It's going to get you nothing because 10 years from now, it's still going to be worth nothing. And 20 years from now, it's going to be worth nothing. There's never going to be a time when it's like, it's time. The world is finally ready to bring Commodore back. No, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, true.
This poor Commodore brand was acquired, this band, I remember for a period was bought by a Dutch company called Tulip.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And they went bankrupt, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was bought by, they had it, then Escom had it, and they went bankrupt, and now it's owned by the creditors of whoever owned it last, so it's
yeah,
not
Commodore
owned.
Holding
yeah, it's
of,
not owned. Yeah. Yeah, it's not owned by any specific company. It's owned by the lawyers of, you know, the people that company, the last company, owed money to. So, so the brand is shot. I mean, it's not coming back in any conceivable way. And it's never, again, there's never going to be a time when it's like, hey, the time is right to bring it back and make a new C64. No, that's not going to happen.
Oh, we are still waiting for the time machine in a DeLorean.
Hmm. Yeah.
No, if they start again to produce 64 Amigas and so on, okay.
Yeah, but that's true.
This kind of stuff.
Again, though, it's a niche market. You could make all new 64s, but look at the 64 Reloaded. That's the closest you can get to a brand new 64, and they're selling them in very very small batches because there's not a lot of people that are going to buy them. It's going to be it's hobbyists and hardcore enthusiasts that are going to go for that because most other people you can just use an emulator, and if you really really want a piece of hardware, you can find them. They're still around.
Yeah, it's
true. So. And you know, making new things, again, you know, it's such a small market that you couldn't have a viable business plan making new 64s or even Amigas. Amigas have a potential because there is Amiga OS is still – it exists, and they were relatively powerful computers. But again, you know, they're kind of frozen at a certain point, and most machines now have lapped them 4 or 5 times as far as what they can do. So at the time that they were made in the early 90s and late 80s, they were beasts, and you know they easily outclassed every other machine on the market. But now that's not the case anymore. And
yeah, but this new Amiga with an architecture old of 50 years old, they have no future as well.
Right.
In my opinion.
Right, because it's a whole new if they try to make a new Amiga or whatever, it's a platform that is largely unsupported, and you know, you're not going to be able to use it as a day-to-day computer because it doesn't have the support, the software support. There's, you know, the last browser I think that was made for it was from like 2002.
No, actually not true. 3 months ago they released a new update for Amiga OS.
They periodically update it, but it's not
including latest browser technology and so on. Like 3 months ago, with a 6 years delay, I have to say. So.
Yeah.
Listen, when the PC started to go out to the office to enter in the houses. With the games, because at the beginning PC was only a professional computer. Mm-hmm. The smart move was to open to the games world for the PC. There was no future for an Amiga or anything, but because they cover all the office or serious stuff, and also they start to develop game when at the beginning Amiga was stronger on this side. So I think Amiga lost the race forever against PC, and as I said, because they also have an architecture too much old. It's not fast. I don't know, because they didn't use the same architecture of the PC,
right?
And keep to develop an old architecture, and for an operative system could be good as you want, but if there are not companies that invest to develop software or games, in my opinion, is dead.
Yeah, you can't. There's nothing to. What we've got entrenched now is pretty much stuck. We're stuck with it. At the time, in the beginning, we had 9 or 10 different platforms to choose from, 64 and Spectrum and Atari and Amiga and whatever else. And now it's boiled down to we've got PC, we have got Mac, and then, you know, 2 or 3 people are using, you know, Linux or Linux or over there. So so breaking into that, even if you made a brand new modern Amiga OS software thing, you couldn't break into it because it you need a user base in order to get support, in order to get the applications made. People need to be using it, and people aren't going to use it without the applications already made. It's kind of like the whole thing with electric cars.
It's called the AmigaOS on a modern PC, maybe, can be a slice of market. But if you can, if you must buy an hardware so much old because the OS can recognize only that kind of hardware, okay.
Well, there isn't there a version of Amiga OS that will run on newer? I know that there's one that will run on, it'll run on PowerPC Max. I don't remember what it's called. It's a
Morph OS.
Yes, Morph OS. And I mean that thing has existed, and
Morph OS. I think it didn't.
And that didn't manage to crack any. You know, any. There's maybe four people that use it, and they only use it as a novelty. It's not like their main machine because, again, you can't do anything with it.
Yeah, there is Morph OS, and there is also a system developed from an Italian, but I don't remember the name. Maybe if I found on the net.
There's a couple different OSs that are that you can install. So there's a thing, a Haiku is one, Morph OS. There's a couple others that you can install on any modern hardware, but again, no one uses any of it, you know, because you need the user base for people to make applications.
Yes, that's it. Icarus.
Yes.
Okay. It was developed by an Italian. That could be an interesting project. The weak point, in my honest opinion, is the art of the Amiga OS is that you must use you are forced to use an hardware that no one is no more interested because it's total obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we have hit 2 hours.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
Thanks for spending the time.
It's been great fun.
Yes.
Talking and taking part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Maybe next time. Okay.
We'll have to do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
Sure. Definitely. As an expert on games or whatsoever, you know a lot of stuff. Oh my god, even about history. I didn't know that. You know,
cool. He's written books about history. Why wouldn't he? How would he not know it?
Well, not about the hardware history. I didn't know that. I knew he knew about the video games, not about the hardware and the company history. So
cool. I'll have to tell you more next time.
Yes.
Great. So have a good evening and a good night. Almost.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Wow. That was awesome, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that was Andrew and Silvio from Scene World magazine, where we are also from.
Yes.
Before we go, I want to bring up also another thing that we said in the last podcast, or maybe the one before that. We were contemplating whether we should stick to a set schedule or if we should, you know, just do a podcast when we do a podcast. And this is a quote that I saw from a guy called Heng Chiang Long.
He
runs a couple of websites, but he said, "Podcasting is not the same medium as radio. We listen to podcasts by subscribing, not by remembering to tune in every week on the same day for the next episode. Podcast producers that pad a self-imposed fixed schedule with reruns and clip shows, as well as podcast client creators that tailor their user interface towards notifications and selections of new episodes to listen to, are not letting go of the old and embracing the new." So, I kind of agree with that, in that we're not... It's a different medium than radio. There's no reason to do it on a regular date if we don't necessarily have anything to do on that date. And we shouldn't just pad out an episode just so we make our schedule. So I think we just keep doing what we're doing.
Well, that's what I'm telling you all the time.
So
who told you that?
That was a quote I saw on a website that I will link in the description below.
Okay, sure. You have to move the causing again because I'm starting causing now.
That's okay. So you know us. We're on Twitter, we're on the web, sceneworld.org. Go there, look at things. I'm not going to go through the whole spiel because we do it every month or every podcast.
Well, youtube.sceneworld.org, sceneworld.org, sceneworld.org/podcast, nafcom.eu, justwestofhell.com. Easy.
Look at us on Twitter, check out the YouTube channel, all that stuff.
If you want to contact us, podcast@sceneworld.org.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll see you. We'll see everybody next podcast.
See you. Enjoy the time without us.